warn all of you of that.
All right. We'll be talking about aging next Tuesday, and then a week from Thursday, we'll have the review for the final exam. So the people that decided to take off early for Thanksgiving are going to be sorry, because several things we'll talk about today will be on the next exam. Okay. All right. On Tuesday, we were talking, today's Tuesday. On Thursday, we were talking about after hyperpolarizations and how they might invalidate a prevailing dogma about synaptic plasticity and how that is the primary mechanism for learning and memory in the nervous system. And if you don't have a long-term memory back to last Thursday, we talked about different criteria that could be applied to basically any phenomenon in the nervous system to see if we can validate the necessity and sufficiency of that as a mechanism to account for a specific function in the nervous system. The changes should correlate, that the time course should be proper, that you shouldn't see the changes if you don't have the function occur, and if you enhance the mechanism, that should have some appropriate effect on the function, and if you prevent the mechanism, that should also have an appropriate effect on the function as well. Okay, you can see these are all interrelated with one another, and ideally any mechanism should be able to meet all of these different criteria. Okay. In the interest of full disclosure, I had you look at some stuff written by a Canadian neuroscientist, Don Hebb, and try to translate it from the Canadian. And we talked about long-term potentiation, which is belabored at length in most textbooks, and the Hebbian rules that most people like to adopt. Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to point out that I was actually trained by people that were students of Hebb's. Okay, so I'm very familiar with his work and with his rules and with his dogma. And at the same time, I still look on them almost as a sort of a pseudo-religious, literally a dogma within the neurosciences. In fact, when we went in experimentally looking for phenomenon like long-term potentiation after learning, this is one of the few studies that actually showed anything even close to long-term potentiation. And in fact, it's not long-term potentiation, it's short-term potentiation. Synaptic potentiation at synapses within the hippocampus. We look specifically at the Schaefer collateral synapses, which are coming in onto CA1 pyramidal neurons from CA3 pyramidal neurons. We also looked at the commissural synapses coming from the opposite hemisphere hippocampus coming into the hippocampus on the contralateral side. So we looked at multiple different sites, multiple different ways. And the best that we were able to find was an hour after learning, we got a slight potentiation of synaptic throughput. But within 24 hours after learning, it was gone. And again, if this is the primary mechanism for learning and memory, it should be persistent as long as the memory persists. And it fails the necessary and sufficiency criteria, every test that has been made of it. As contrary to this other phenomenon that I've spent most of the last 15 years or more looking at, which is changes in the after hyperpolarization, changes in calcium-dependent potassium conductances that very strongly regulate the activity of hippocampal neurons and enable them then to pass on information to other regions of the nervous system. As a part of the limbic system circuitry, they then allow the information to flow out of the hippocampus and to the rest of the limbic system, where it can then be consolidated into new proteins and actually then physically stored as memories. It's not physically stored in the hippocampus, but it's necessary for the information to get through the hippocampus, or you don't form the long-term memory. So again, Only the animals that learn show the AHP reductions. Animals that haven't gone through training, animals that are dummies, animals that have gone through various control conditions don't show the changes. We've shown it specifically to date only in pyramidal neurons. Initially in the hippocampus, so everything that's in yellow here, I've done myself in my own lab. Anything that's underlined, not only in my lab, but multiple other labs have replicated it as well. So we've seen it consistently in CA1 and also in CA3 pyramidal neurons in the hippocampus. Very recently, we've been looking at pyramidal neurons in the amygdala, in both the basolateral and lateral amygdala, and consistently seeing learning-related changes in those populations as well. And it's also been widely reported and replicated about a dozen times now in neurons in piriform cortex, primary olfactory cortex. And again, in pyramidal neuron populations, but not in other phenotypes of neurons. In fact, we've consistently looked at the other major cell type in the hippocampus, granule neurons, and we fail to see any AHP reductions in those populations. In fact, your TA, Linda, has been showing AHP increases in dentate rather than decreases. So this reduction in the increase in information flow seems to be specific to pyramidal neurons. Again, those are the output neurons from these various regions. Okay. So this may be a pyramidal neuron specific phenotypic mechanism. There's obviously lots of other brain regions we need to test. First obvious one is to step through the remainder of the limbic system. Look at pyramidal neuron populations, for instance, in prefrontal cortex and cingulate cortex. There aren't any pyramidal neurons in places like the septum. So maybe there will be an alternative mechanism there, or maybe this mechanism will not exist in some regions of the limbic system. We obviously need to fill in the rest of the complete circuit. There's other regions of the nervous system, though, that are not involved in these types of learning tasks or these specific types of memory tasks. We've looked at things in a number of different species to date, in rabbits, rats, mice, and other groups have looked in cats as well. And it's been general across all these different species where we've looked. Obviously, we're not going to get volunteers to come in and give us human hippocampus, but hopefully at some point in the future, we'll be collaborating with another group to look at changes in primate hippocampus. Not human, but as close as we can get to see if this is general across an even wider range of species. We've tested it in a number of different learning tasks. And so far, all the different types of declarative memory types of tasks that we've tested it in, it's been seen. Obviously, there are thousands of other alternatives that we haven't tested yet. So we need to continue the range of testing as well. Shouldn't be satisfied just when you get a phenomenon and stick with what works. Should try to push the boundaries of that as well. So you can find things where it doesn't work and then try to explain why it doesn't work in those situations. Okay. Again, the time course of these AHP changes was very specific and appropriate for the other information we know about the function of the hippocampus. The changes, again, don't show up in control populations, either naives or animals that have gone through the same behavioral experiences, but were unable to make the learned association between different pieces of information. Doesn't show up in dummies, but it shows up during the learning process, late in the learning process, and also importantly, it continues during the period when memory consolidation is occurring. And only for that period. After the memory is consolidated, the changes go back to baseline. It's no longer needed. Yet the memory is perfectly intact. In these eye blink conditioning tasks, we've tested animals up to a year later. The memory is perfectly intact. They remember as well as the day that they learned. And all of you remember your name right now. You don't stumble over that. Unless you've been ingesting certain pharmacological agents, perhaps. And yet, if we bring the animals back for testing and ask them to show us they've got the memory and then look at the hippocampus, so they're re-expressing the memory, they're recalling it, again, the hippocampus does not show these changes. It's only during that critical time period when the animals are learning it initially and consolidating it initially that we see these changes. So it's highly specific. It's not just a global type phenomenon. Okay. We pushed it a bit further. We look at it in aging models. So in various species, these are considered aging populations for rabbits and for rats. If you recall, the average amplitude of young animals is shown by this dotted line, and aging animals have a much larger AHP. So aging actually makes this worse, and as a consequence, their learning is worse. They're much slower to learn. Yet aging animals that successfully learn still show these changes. So it's still retained as a mechanism in the successful learning population. It's as if the animals that cannot modulate the AHP and make it smaller cannot learn. The flip side, if we directly manipulate the AHP, if we use pharmacological agents to make the AHP smaller or to make it larger, we can impact learning. So in this example, we're using a set of calcium channel blockers. The specific drug here is one that's called nimodipine. Crosses the blood-brain barrier. In this case, though, it's being applied directly in a hippocampal slice preparation. This is the naive state, and this is after the drug. Calcium channel blockers reduce the amplitude of AHPs in an indirect fashion. What kind of potassium channels were these? Calcium-dependent potassium channels. So you block the entry of calcium, you reduce the amplitude of these potassium currents. Okay, if you compare the naive spike firing to sustained input, and then after application of a calcium channel blocker, man, the lights really interfere with this, you get an increase in the firing activity. Again, more information flowing through the hippocampus when we block the calcium channels. Not only do we get a change in physiology, but we get a change in learning. Naive aging animals take a certain number of trials to acquire a specific task, in this case, the trace sibling conditioning task. If we apply the dose of calcium channel blockers that change the physiology, it also changes the behavior. Animals learn much faster. And in fact, the calcium channel blocker is much more effective in aging populations than in young ones. There's not as much to act upon in younger populations. The AHPs are smaller to start with. So we can produce an even greater change by blocking calcium entry in aging neurons. It's a dose-dependent effect on the learning. There's an optimal dose that we've reliably replicated multiple times. So the pharmacology of it's pretty straightforward. If we look at the firing of the neurons in the intact behaving animal, follows the same dose dependence. So the effect in a reduced preparation or in the intact brain is identical. And if we look at the specific calcium-dependent potassium currents that underlie the AHP phenomenon, we can again show a dose-dependent reduction in those AHP currents. So we're moving across multiple levels of analysis from the sort of global domain of learning and memory on down to the domain of individual proteins and multiple steps in between as well.
What's DHP?
Dihydropyridine. It's a specific class of calcium channel blockers. All right, so again, back to that necessary and sufficiency criteria. For the AHP reductions, we consistently see that AHP reductions correlate with learning. Meets that first criteria. The time course is appropriate. for learning and memory consolidation. Not for recall, not for other aspects of learning and memory, but for particular aspects. We do not see the HP reductions in the absence of learning. When we block HPs, when we make them smaller, animals learn faster. And when AHPs are enhanced, it actually impairs learning. So we can manipulate the mechanism in both a positive and a negative fashion. Essentially then, the necessary and sufficiency criteria are fully met for this mechanism. And met in multiple species, multiple learning tasks, and we still don't know if it's specific to a single phenotype of neuron, but the data at this point suggests it may be. So this is a primary learning mechanism in the hippocampus, critically required for acquisition of new information and consolidation of that information into long-term memories. Not the mechanism by which the memories are stored. That, we only know, requires protein synthesis. We don't know which specific proteins or where. We know a lot about the underlying molecular mechanisms regulating the changes in the AHP. Those of you that had pharmacology will recall there are at least two major classes of calcium-dependent potassium channels. One of the two classes is the SK category. And for SKs, the calcium sensor is a molecule called calmodulin. It has four binding sites for calcium. So it's very sensitive to multiple calcium levels. We still don't know the protein that constitutes the other major type, which is called the slow AHP channels, or SAHP channels. But we do now know the calcium sensor. And it's this calcium binding protein. It's called hippocalcin. Hippocalcin. Named by someone with a sense of humor for the hippocampus. Hippocalcin. It looks a lot like calmodulin, with one exception. Instead of having binding sites for four calcium ions, it has binding sites for three. Again, sensitive to a wide range of calcium concentrations. So we now know the calcium sensing mechanism for the two major classes of calcium-dependent potassium channels that contribute to the after-hyperpolarization. There are several other types of calcium-dependent channels, but they do not contribute significantly to the after-hyperpolarization. In the case of calmodulin, we've done extensive studies with calmodulin inhibitors or calmodulin blockers. The most potent one we found to date is a compound with the exotic name of W7. The native AHP is shown here, and after application of the calmodulin blocker, we can reduce the AHP. And in fact, we can do it dose dependently, and it acts differently in aging than in young tissue. Aging neurons appear to express more SK channels, so not surprising that the dose dependence is different across the age ranges. Okay. W7 has not been tested for behavioral effects. If it reduces the AHP, though, what would the prediction be with the behavioral effect? Should it enhance learning or degrade learning? Should enhance learning. We're probably not going to test it because calmodulin has so many other effects besides effects on the AHP. It affects adenylate cyclase activity, it affects different phosphatase activity, in fact, it affects all kinds of other enzyme systems in the body. It's probably not a good drug to test for learning and memory effects, because you'd have lots of other side effects. Instead, we've looked at drugs that directly block the SK-type channels. Okay, the one class of calcium-dependent potassium channels that use calmodulin as their sensor. So we have a number of different drugs we've tried. One is a compound called declinium. It's actually a compound that was derived from ancient Chinese medical texts. It's being used in clinical settings for a wide range of different applications. You can buy it in various Chinese groceries in preparations in a throat lozenge if you have a sore throat. It's being used as a chemotherapy agent, and it very effectively blocks calcium-dependent potassium channels of the SK type in a nice dose-dependent fashion. The higher the dose, the greater the block of the channel. We've also used a toxic peptide called apamin. Apamin comes from the Latin name for honeybees, Apis mellifera. Apamin is one of the constituents in bee venom. And in fact, there's been extensive tests of its ability to enhance learning and memory. And when we look at its effects on the after hyperpolarization, it again reduces the AHP amplitude. If we look at the effect on the currents themselves, apamin effectively blocks the AHP. And if we add declinium to apamin, we get an even more dramatic reduction in the AHP. We've done one set of studies so far behaviorally testing the effects of declinium and got an improvement in learning and memory. But we still need to finish out the complete dose response curve on that to find the optimal dose of declinium. Again, those of you that have had pharmacology, this should seem familiar to you. Those that haven't, don't worry about it. If you think back to what we talked about last Thursday, there was a common mechanism that Kandel points out in his invertebrate learning studies that won him a Nobel Prize. That eventually you got an enhancement in production of PKA, protein kinase A, and that led to a sustained increase in synaptic transmission in his sea slugs. And then he made the leap that enhanced levels of PKA can also contribute to long-term potentiation in the hippocampus. Well, Kandel's right about that, but he's also wrong, because LTP is not the mechanism. Turns out PKA has lots of other useful effects in mechanisms that actually show up consistently in learning, including activation of pathways that enhance PKA production and PKA activity. This is again in the native control state. And after adding agonists that enhance PKA, PKA blocks the AHP by phosphorylating these channels. And it turns out that that applies to both the SK type channels and to these slow AHP channels. In fact, not only does increases in PKA, but also increases in PKC and in CAM kinase all result in increased phosphorylation of these potassium channels, and all can reduce the AHP. So there's pathways for basically every known neurotransmitter to have an effect on the AHP. And that's what's shown up here. I certainly don't expect you to memorize all those different pathways, but we've explored a number of them in my lab over the last 10 years' time. certain types of dopamine agonists, certain types of histamine agonists, beta agonists for norepinephrine, various serotonin pathways, various cholinergic pathways, various glutamate pathways. And I'll show you just a little bit of that. Okay. It's been known for a long time that cholinergic antagonists interfere with learning, and specific cholinergic agonists actually enhance learning. And in fact, we've done a number of studies related to that ourselves. But you get an enhancement, particularly with M1-specific agonists, one of the major classes of muscarinic cholinergic agonists. Not only do we get an enhancement in learning, we get a reduction in the AHP, an enhancement in the firing activity of the neurons, and specific reductions in the AHP currents, underlying the sort of macro scale AHP. Again, all the sorts of things that we'd like to see hang together in a consistent fashion. Behavioral effects, neuronal effects at the cellular and network level, and effects down to the individual channels. Glutamate-mediated pathways, in this case, metabotropic glutamate-mediated pathways. mGluR1s. These tie in via either PKC or CAM kinase. The native AHP, and after application of the agonist, a reduction in the AHP. Increase in firing activity, reduction in the current generated by the calcium-dependent potassium currents. Haven't done any behavioral testing yet. But again, the prediction, if it does all these things to the physiology, it should enhance acquisition and consolidation of memory as well. NMDA receptors. Anyone heard of NMDA receptors before? Your textbook talks a lot about the importance of NMDA receptors for learning and memory. And in fact, it focuses on the importance of NMDA receptors for LTP. There's in fact been a 30-year literature on the critical importance of NMDA receptors for production of long-term potentiation, and to a lesser degree, their importance in production of LTD as well, long-term depression. And I'm not going to bore everybody with a repetition of the biophysical characteristics of NMDA receptors. I'm not going to test you on it either. Something interesting going on out there?
I was talking about the stairs.
Okay. You might go tell them to shut the door or something, Chris.
We can still hear you.
Shut the door.
Awesome.
Michael, you want to go back and ask them if they shut the door or Chris? You have to actually step outside and shut the door. It's long been known that complete blockade of NMDA receptors severely degrades learning and memory. Okay? If I asked Chris to volunteer and come up here and I injected him with a high dose of angel dust, PCP, and then told him he had to take the final exam, he'd probably not do very well on it. In fact, he probably wouldn't do very well on finishing the rest of today's class. And that sort of phenomenon has been known for a long time. We're not going to do that experiment, Chris. Okay.
I want to get excited.
Oh, well. In fact, this is examples in iBlink conditioning where you can dose-dependently have normal learning, and you step the dose of various NMDA antagonists up and interfere with the learning. You can essentially zero it out. You could also do the flip side, make learning better by modulating NMDA receptors. And when I first published this in a Nature paper back in the early 90s, we thought this compound, which is a partial agonist of the NMDA receptor, was doing the opposite of what antagonists were doing. Normal learning shown here, and after enhanced activation with a partial agonist of the NMDA receptor, the animals actually learned better. Turns out we were wrong about the mechanism, but we were right about the drug effect. This effect's been replicated now hundreds of times. But the mechanism, it turned out, was wrong, and we had to do more studies to find out why it was wrong. Okay. We went through and did complete dose response studies. We found optimal doses to maximally enhance learning. It took a particular dose in young animals, and in aging animals, it took about twice the dose. Well, aging animals have twice the number of NMDA receptors. So it actually followed the physical chemistry at the cellular level of the NMDA receptors. It applies across different tasks, same optimal dose, different species.
I was just curious about if there have ever been any studies done over Adderall and Ritalin to affect learning in a positive manner, or if they do have anything to do with that.
There have, but the results have been very mixed. And they would indirectly affect the AHP. Nobody's looked at it, though, as a mechanism. But they obviously affect dopamine levels in the nervous system. And the D1-like receptors can actually positively influence and reduce the AHP. But the D2-like receptors would have the opposite effect. And Adderall is not specific for either type. So it can produce a mixed effect. And in fact, the outcome for the large population that's taking those compounds has been sort of mixed in terms of improvement in learning. It at least lets people sit still in the classroom, which seems to be the real goal. Whether they're learning better in the classroom is a different question. Well, we went in and did more detailed studies of this partial agonist, we found out that instead of actually enhancing activity at NMDA receptors, which would have been a nice Hebbian mechanism to enhance LTP, instead it actually blocked AHPs. It reduced AHPs. To understand that, you've got to understand a bit about NMDA receptors. Is going to work really well with the dead marker. Okay. Anybody remember what ion flows into NMDA receptors? Calcium. Okay. Enhancing NMDA receptor activity should do what to calcium levels coming into the cell? Increase it or decrease it? Increase it. Okay. And all the Hebbian models postulate that you need more calcium coming in to get LTP, and to get synaptic potentiation, and to get learning. Increasing calcium, though, would be a bad thing if the mechanism is AHP reductions. We have more calcium coming in aging neurons. And do aging populations learn better? They learn worse. Aging populations, do they have larger or smaller AHPs? They have larger AHPs. Big AHPs are bad for learning. So if this drug, a partial agonist, was enhancing calcium influx, the hypothesis that we tested should have been an increase in the AHP. Would have meant our mechanism was a bad one for learning. Instead, the drug actually reduces AHPs in a consistent dose-dependent fashion. Whether we evoke the AHPs by our typical mechanism of intracellular current injection, or if we evoke them by stimulation of the Schaefer collaterals through a synaptic mechanism. Either way, it dose-dependently reduces AHPs, not increases it. and yet it also very strongly facilitates learning. So it's consistent with the hypothesis that the HP reduction is important for learning and memory. It violates the assumption that LTP is important. We then went in with other compounds pharmacologically different from this drug, but that target one specific subunit of the NMDA receptor, the GluR1 subunit, the subunit that has the glycine site for the NMDA receptor. And in fact, we're able to replicate the effect by partly blocking calcium influx, by partly blocking that subunit, we were able to decrease calcium into the neuron and decrease the AHP. In fact, if we use a low enough dose of the drugs that we'd shown in previous studies and that hundreds of other labs had shown prevented learning, a low enough dose actually facilitated learning. What was the title of the last section of the class that involved eating and drinking and homeostasis? If you push the nervous system out of its normal homeostatic range, it doesn't function well. If you apply complete blockade of NMDA receptors, you're way out of the normal homeostatic range. What we did was find a drug that modulated things within the homeostatic range in a very narrow dose range. We're actually decreasing NMDA receptor activity had a beneficial effect because it decreased AHPs. By ignoring the dogma of how the brain worked, we actually found a more beneficial way to facilitate learning. Okay. And in fact, we can do the opposite as well. We apply a full agonist rather than a partial agonist serine, we can actually make AHPs bigger. So we can go to the opposite end of the homeostatic range as well. And by increasing calcium influx, we can actually make AHPs larger. So we have a real good idea of the range that we need to be working within by taking advantage of these various pharmacological tools. And in fact, if we look at synaptic potentials, which underlie long-term potentiation, D-cycloserine makes the synaptic potential smaller, anti-LTP. And serine that makes the AHPs larger also makes the EPSPs larger. Larger EPSPs, if that's required for learning, produces worse effects on the AHPs. So if you need larger EPSPs, you're acting counter to the AHP mechanism. Long-term potentiation actually seems to do the wrong thing for learning rather than the correct thing. So not only is it's wrong in a very bad way. And yet the field has been stuck on that as the mechanism for the last 30 years and more. Probably not a good thing. All right, so obviously we've just sort of begun this story. There's a lot of other ways to go. Lots of other cell types to investigate, lots of other learning mechanisms, because all we've looked at and seen this consistent change in is pyramidal neurons. We need to look at the rest of the limbic system and see what's going on in the rest of the limbic system as well. Is it consistent with this mechanism or is it different? Our hypothesis right now is that if we look at pyramidal neuron populations, the output populations, throughout the rest of the limbic system, we're probably going to see these same changes. We made that hypothesis and then tested it in the amygdala and saw it so far. We've seen it in primary olfactory cortex. And in fact, people have begun looking in various auditory cortices and seeing it there as well. There's been a group lately looking at it in somatosensory cortex, and they've got some data consistent with it. But a lot more work needs to be done. It's probably going to turn out to be a different mechanism for other forms of memory, like motor memory. Changes going on in the cerebellum, there aren't any pyramidal neurons. So we can probably assume that it may well be a different mechanism. But I think at this point, it's fairly safe to assume we should not make the assumption that it's going to be LTP in a lot of cases. Or we ought to be able to show LTP meeting those necessary and sufficient criteria. And we should not just buy what the textbooks tell us about it. Okay. So I wanted to acknowledge some of the people that I worked with doing this sort of stuff. My graduate school advisor, Phil Best, at the University of Virginia, and then various other faculty that I worked in their labs as well. My postdoc advisor, John Disterhoft at Northwestern, and then John and I collaborated in a lot of projects when I became a faculty member at Northwestern for about 9 years before I came here. And then various students that have gotten their PhD in my lab, a number of other faculty that I've collaborated on in this work, and then various students that are still in my lab, or master's students, or literally, at this point in time, close to 100 different undergrads that have worked in the lab as well. Okay. I could show 40 or 50 more slides of different data related to it, but I think that's probably more than enough for today. Okay. Have a good holiday.